Section 1. You will hear two students, Jacinta and Lewis, discussing a holiday they are planning in Queenstown, a tourist center in New Zealand popular with young people. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 6. Now we shall begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, because you will not hear the recording a second time. Listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 6.
Hi, Lewis. It's Jacinta here.
Oh, hi, Jacinta. I was just going to call you. I was thinking we ought to do something about accommodation for our trip to Queenstown.
Yeah, actually, that's just why I rang you. I've been looking on the internet. There was one place that looked okay called Traveller's Lodge. But when I checked availability for January, when we're planning to go, I found it was fully booked.
Right. Well, we'd better do something now, I suppose.
I've actually got a list up here on the computer. There's one place called Bingley's that looks possible. It's $19.75 a night. That's US dollars. They quote all the prices in US dollars.
So that's about 26 or 27 New Zealand dollars. That's okay. That'll be in a dormitory, is it?
Yeah, they say 8-bed dorms. And the hostel's right in the town centre. And they've got a cafe. They have theme nights every weekend, whatever that means.
Oh, you know, like certain sorts of food and music. And people might wear special clothes like that Egyptian evening we went to last year.
Oh, okay. What else? They've got a sun deck area and then all the usual things, internet access and so on.
Sounds good. Was there anywhere else?
Yeah, a couple more places. There's one called Chalet Lodge, which is just 18 US dollars. That's for a bed in a 12-bed dorm. They do single and family rooms as well. It looks as if it's a bit out of town. Says it's got an alpine setting. A quiet alpine setting. What do you think?
Not sure.
Oh, but actually it's not far out at all. It says 10 minutes walk from town, so... Oh, and it says it's children-friendly.
I'm not so sure about that. What about the third place?
That's called Globetrotters. Let's see. They do private rooms or 5-bed dorms for $18.50. It's in the centre, just by the lake, and that includes breakfast.
Didn't the other two?
I don't think so. They didn't mention it, so probably not. Oh, and it says something about a free skydive. Wow.
Don't know if I'm all that keen on jumping out of aeroplanes.
Oh, actually, what it says is you can win a chance to do a skydive. They give one away every day to one of the guests.
Well, if I win it, you can do it. Anyway, do they have room?
Yeah, I checked the availability. Shall I go ahead and book there then?
Fine.
You now have some time to look at questions 7 to 10 on page 89. Now listen and answer questions 7 to 10.
I was looking at what there is to do too. There are lots of sites offering deals for adventure sports. I suppose we have to do a bungee jump.
Why?
Well, it's Queenstown where they more or less started it as a sport.
You can, if you really want to jump off the side of a bridge with an elastic rope tied around your ankles. I'll watch.
Okay, so what do you want to do?
As far as adventure sports go, I was talking to someone who went whitewater rafting there. He said it was really awesome. They drive you up the Shotover River, and then you come down on a rubber raft through the whitewater rapids, where the river's really narrow and fast, and end up going through a tunnel nearly 200 metres long. I think it's quite expensive, though.
Oh, I'm on for that if you are.
Cool.
The other thing you can do is the jet boat ride. That sounded just a lot of noise, though. It's basically just whizzing round on the river on a very fast boat, isn't it?
My friend did that as well. He said it was a bit touristy, but worth it. I'll give it a go. You go right up the river canyon. He said the drivers were really skillful, but I don't mind going on my own.
But there's lots to do as well as the whole commercial adventure bit. We ought to do some trekking. The scenery around there's amazing. I don't want to miss that. The place to start's Glenorchy, apparently, about 40 minutes' drive. That's where lots of the wilderness trails begin.
Okay. I'll pack my walking boots. I'd better start getting in training. I haven't done anything except sit at my desk for months. Now, is there anything else we need to decide?
That is the end of section one. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section 2 on page 90. Section 2. You will hear a local radio program about cycling courses in London. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 14 on page 90. Now listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 14.
There's been a great deal of interest lately in encouraging people to use bicycles instead of cars as a means of transport. But not everyone is confident about riding a bike at the best of times, let alone in the middle of a city like London. Jack Hayes is a professional trainer who works for a London-based company, City Cyclist, which provides cycle training for the public. What exactly does City Cyclist do, Jack?
Well, our basic purpose is to promote cycling as a sustainable form of transport. We believe the best way to promote cycling is to teach people to use their bikes safely and with confidence. In European countries, people all learned from their parents, and they also learned in school. And when I tell them I teach people to ride bikes, they laugh. They think it's crazy. But here in London, it's completely different. You're approaching the point where a whole generation of people have grown up not being allowed by their parents to cycle because it was considered to be getting too dangerous. And so, in turn, they can't teach their children. We believe in realistic training. So if someone wants to use a bike regularly, say to get to work or school, we aim to train them by teaching them to ride on the actual roads they'll use, so they can develop the basic skills they need and build up their confidence that way. At City Cyclist, we believe cycling's for everyone, no matter what age or level of ability or mobility. We do complete beginners and also advanced courses. That's for urban cyclists who want to deal with things like riding in streets with complicated intersections and things like that. We don't promote the use of personal protective equipment for cyclists, and we endorse the policy of the European Cyclists Federation that parents should be allowed to make an informed choice as to whether or not their child wears a helmet. We believe the key to safe cycling is assertiveness, taking your place on the road. This has to be instilled right from the beginning. Assertive road positioning and behaviour is the key to safe cycling in congested urban environments. Some people are surprised that we don't promote the segregation of cyclists from motorised traffic, but we don't think that's practical in all urban environments. Instead, we teach people to use as much road space as they need to travel safely and effectively.
You now have some time to look at questions 15 to 20 on page 91. Now listen and answer questions 15 to 20.
Now, as well as courses for individuals, City Cyclist provides a number of services for organisations. For example, we can deliver fun, safe cycle training activities at schools, arranging courses so that the disruption of curriculum time is kept to a minimum. As well as this, in order to promote safe cycling, we have provided training courses for employees and staff of local councils. And we are also increasingly looking at developing training courses in companies in order to help employers work towards green transport plans by helping to increase the number of staff cycling to work. Right, so that's a brief summary of what we do. If any listeners would like to find out more about the organisation, you can have a look at our website. That's City Cyclist. CITICyclist.co.uk. And in order to book lessons, you can either phone us on 020-7562-4028 or do it online. There's an application form on our website, and you can just download that and send it in. We charge £27.50 per hour for one-to-one lessons, plus £6 for each extra person. So you're looking at just £39.50 for a family of three, say. If you've never been on a bike in your life before, we reckon we can get you riding in 1 hour. And for most people, a course of road training usually takes 3 hours. But whether you're a parent or a child, an individual or an institution, we'll be happy to discuss your special needs and make a program just for you.
That is the end of section two. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section 3 on page 92. Section 3. You will hear a conversation between a student, Dave, and his tutor about a project that Dave has done about work placements. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 25 on page 42. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 25.
Good afternoon, Dave. Come on in and take a seat.
Hi, Dr. Green. Thanks.
Oh, hang on a minute. I'll just find the first draft of your project paper and we can have a look at it together. Now, yours is the one on work placement, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
So what made you choose that for your project?
Well, I suppose it was because sending students off to various companies for work experience seems to be such a typical part of educational courses these days. I mean, even school kids get to do it. But I felt everyone just kind of assumes it's a good thing. And I guess I wanted to find out if that's the case.
But you don't look at schools or colleges, right? You've stuck to university placement schemes.
Yeah, well, I quickly found that I had to limit my research. Otherwise, the area was just too big. Do you think that was okay?
I think it's very sensible, especially as the objectives might be very different. So how many schemes did you look at?
Well, I sent out about 150 questionnaires altogether. You know, 50 of each to university authorities, students and companies. And I got responses from 15 educational institutions and 30 students in 11 individual companies.
Great. That sounds like a good sample. And who did you send your company questionnaires to?
Well, the idea was to have them done by the students' line managers. But sometimes they were filled in by the human resources manager or even the owner of the company.
Right. I didn't find a full list anywhere. So I think it's very important to provide that, really. You can put it as an appendix at the back.
Right. I've got a record of all the respondents, so that'll be easy. I hope other things were okay. I mean, I've already put such a lot of work into this project, identifying the companies and so on.
Oh, I can tell. I think you've done a good job overall.
You now have some time to look at questions 26 to 30 on page 43. Now listen and answer questions 26 to 30.
I thought your questionnaires were excellent, and you'd obviously done lots of background reading. But there were a few problems with the introduction. First of all, I think you need to make some slight changes to the organisation of your information there. At present, it's a bit confused.
Okay. What did you have in mind?
Well, you write quite a bit about work placement in general, but you never explain what you mean by the term.
So you think I should give a definition?
Exactly. And the introduction is the place to do it. And then, look, you start talking about what's been written on the topic, but it's all a bit mixed up with your own project.
So do you think it would be better to have two sections there, like a survey of the literature as the introduction, and then a separate section on the aims of my research?
I do. You can include your methods for collecting data in the second section too. It would be much clearer for your reader. You know, establish the background first, then how your work relates to it. It would flow quite nicely then.
Yes, I see what you mean.
Anyway, moving on. I like the way you've grouped your findings into three main topic areas.
Well, it became very obvious from the questionnaires that the preparation stage was really important for the whole scheme to work. So I had to look at that first. And I found a huge variation between the different institutions, as you saw.
I was wondering if you could give a summary at the end of this stage of what you consider to be the best practice you found. I think that would be very helpful.
Right, I'll just make a note of that. What did you think of my second set of findings on key skills development? For me, this is the core of my whole project, really.
And you've handled it very well. I wouldn't want you to make any changes. You've already got a nice final focus on good practice there.
Thanks.
Right. Now, I think the last part, which deals with the reasons why students don't learn...
What, the constraints on learning chapter?
Yes, that's the one. I think you need to refer to the evidence from your research a bit more closely here. You know, maybe you could illustrate it with quotations from the questionnaires, or even use any extracts from a student diary if you can. And refer back to what you've written about good practice.
That is the end of section 3. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section 4 on page 44. Section 4. You will hear a part of a lecture about learning and bilingualism. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40 on pages 44 and 45. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
When we look at theories of education and learning, we see a constant shifting of views as established theories are questioned and refined or even replaced. And we can see this very clearly in the way that attitudes towards bilingualism have changed. Let's start with a definition of bilingualism. And for our purposes today, we can say it's the ability to communicate with the same degree of proficiency in at least two languages. Now, in practical terms, this might seem like a good thing, something we'd all like to be able to do. However, early research done with children in the USA in fact suggested that being bilingual interfered in some way with learning and with the development of their mental processes. And so in those days, bilingualism was regarded as something to be avoided, and parents were encouraged to bring their children up as monolingual, just speaking one language. But this research, which took place in the early part of the 20th century, is now regarded as unsound for various reasons, mainly because it didn't take into account other factors such as the children's social and economic backgrounds. Now, in our last lecture, we were looking at some of the research that's been done into the way children learn, into their cognitive development, and in fact we believe now that the relationship between bilingualism and cognitive development is actually a positive one. It turns out that cognitive skills such as problem solving, which don't seem at first glance to have anything to do with how many languages you speak, are better among bilingual children than monolingual ones. And quite recently, there's been some very interesting work done by Ellen Bialystok at York University in Canada. She's been doing various studies on the effects of bilingualism, and her findings provide some evidence that they might apply to adults as well. They're not just restricted to children. So how do you go about investigating something like this? Well, Dr. Bialystok used groups of monolingual and bilingual subjects aged from 30 right up to 88. For one experiment, she used a computer program which displayed either a red or a blue square on the screen. The coloured square could come up on either the left-hand or the right-hand side of the screen. If the square was blue, the subject had to press the left shift key on the keyboard. And if the square was red, they had to press the right shift key. So they didn't have to react at all to the actual position of the square on the screen, just to the colour they saw. And she measured the subject's reaction times by recording how long it took them to press the shift key and how often they got it right. What she was particularly interested in was whether it took the subject longer to react when a square lit up on one side of the screen, say the left, and the subject had to press the shift key on the right-hand side. She'd expected that it would take more processing time than if a square lit up on the left and the candidates had to press a left key. This was because of a phenomenon known as the Simon effect, where basically the brain gets a bit confused because of conflicting demands being made on it. In this case, seeing something on the right and having to react on the left. And this causes a person's reaction times to slow down. The results of the experiment showed that the bilingual subjects responded more quickly than the monolingual ones. That was true both when the squares were on the correct side of the screen, so to speak, and even more so when they were not. So bilingual people were better able to deal with the Simon effect than the monolingual ones. So what's the explanation for this? Well, the result of the experiment suggests that bilingual people are better at ignoring information which is irrelevant to the task in hand and just concentrating on what's important. One suggestion given by Dr. Bialystok was that it might be because someone who speaks two languages can suppress the activity of parts of the brain when it isn't needed. In particular, the part that processes whichever language isn't being used at that particular time. Well, she then went on to investigate that with a second experiment. But again, the bilingual group performed better. And what was particularly interesting, and this is, I think, why the experiments have received so much publicity, is that in all cases, the performance gap between monolinguals and bilinguals actually increased with age, which suggests that bilingualism protects the mind against decline. So in some way, the lifelong experience of managing two languages may prevent some of the negative effects of ageing. So that's a very different story from the early research. So what are the implications of this for education?
That is the end of section 4. You now have half a minute to check your answers. That is the end of the listening test. You now have 10 minutes to transfer your answers to the separate answer sheet.